Well, you had that list there, too. Is there anything beyond that that...
Well, a lot of this is after Vietnam, of course.
Right.
During Vietnam, we had a lot of... I had about 300 different projects there.
How long did you stay with Westmoreland then?
Well, I stayed until he left, and afterward. He left in June of 68, and I stayed on until early 69 with General Abe. I still felt I left too early because there's so much left to do. But let me tell you a couple of other projects in Vietnam. I'll give you some feel for the...
The place is pretty well covered with jungle, and one of the techniques of the Army, of course, is to use helicopters to put down a patrol or insert a group. But the natural clearings are all well known to the enemy, and they frequently have them rigged so that standard technique is you have an artillery prep that fires artillery all around there, and while that's going on, they take to their holes, and the first aircraft comes in and dumps its load, but by the time the second one comes in, these guys crawl out of their holes and have hold of the switches on the mines and whatnot, and the second aircraft and the crew get blasted out of existence. So the question arose, is it possible to create a landing zone? Well, the Marines tried lowering guys with chainsaws to cut down. That takes all day, and it makes a lot of noise, and clearly is a loser. But I thought the right way to do it is use a big bomb and blast a hole and blow the trees down. Well, we had lots of arguments in the office whether that would work or not. But there was a young Air Force colonel who was visiting out there for a month. I used to have these sort of exchange visitors from the Pentagon. And he didn't have any. He wanted a problem. So I said, you go over to 7th Air Force and get the biggest strapping bomb they've got, and let's run an experiment. And he did, a very beautiful experiment. It took 2 weeks. The ground forces were extremely interested in this, so they gave him lots of support to put this up in the Kontum area. Lowered the bomb through the canopy, set it up right, just above ground level. He had his guys make a map with it in all directions of the trees, where they are, and the sizes, and so on. Then we set out a 3,000-pound bomb, which is the biggest standard bomb available. And 30 seconds after that went off, one of my guys landed a helicopter in that cleared zone, showing it works. Pictures and all that. So, clearly that was something that they wanted to develop. So two of the other guys, another Air Force colonel and this Army helicopter pilot, Bill Denham was his name, took that project back to the U.S., and we got funding through the Air Force. I had very good support from the military for these things. And they spent the next 6 months developing a 10,000-pound bomb and the ability to drop it. Now, they were very wise, wiser than I might have been. They developed the capability to use not only the Crane helicopter, the big heavy-lift helicopter, but also the C-130, which is an Air Force airplane. Now, to get into roles and missions, you know, a touchy subject. Anyway, the Marines requested that we create some landing zones for them. They had four places, and we did that with the Crane helicopter. One of them lit on a hillside, so it wasn't suitable, but the other three worked like a charm. And word of that got around and got to the Air Force, and they said, no more of that. We're the guys that dropped the bombs. No more Army. So after that, we used the C-130, and that that operation was known as Combat Trap, and over the course of the war, we dropped about 300 of those. Not, they weren't aimed at anybody, they were aimed at clearing the jungle. So that was one of them. Another one was early on, Harold Agnew, who was director of Livermore, director of Los Alamos, said to me, I've got all these 8,000 guys here that could do wonders. What do you need? So I said, well, location of our enemy artillery is an important issue. Let me explain where that comes from. We had, by this time, we had the so-called McNamara barrier going in, which was or planned to go in. This consisted of, if this is Vietnam, this is the DMZ, divides North and South Vietnam. Here is Khe Sanh, over here is Chipone and Laos. And this area up about halfway is about flat. This is something like 50 kilometers wide. And the idea was to build a conventional barrier in here of consisting of a fence and mines and all that kind of stuff. But this was widely advertised, and of course the North Vietnamese knew what was going on. And they saw this as inhibiting their activity up here. They had a couple of beam divisions, 324B was up here, and they'd run across, zap the villages here and run back, you know, like playing squat tag.
Mm-hmm.
And so they saw that as a threat to their activities, and they moved down artillery into this area. They had about 100 pieces of 152 caliber artillery. It's in a good range on it. Now this was in the spring of 1967. I had a bunch of things going on up here at Contien and Jiulin, a number of scientific type of experiments. And they bombarded this whole area with about 1,000 rounds a day. Very noisy. All my guys were under the earth. I didn't lose anybody over there. But I had more people up there my shop that the Marines did. At any rate, it became clear that there was no way that you could put a construction battalion out there in the open building this fence. So the question arose, how do you suppress this artillery? This was a big meeting in Westy's office, and the head of the 7th Air Force, Spike Mumar, was asked to bomb them out of existence, which he agreed to try to do. But again, you know, the analysis never caught up with the problem was that these artillery pieces were all riveted. Here's your artillery piece sitting here, you know. The radius is 5 meters. And the revetment is a couple of meters high. And that means you've got to get the bomb inside. Moreover, although we had VT fuses, proximity fuses in World War II, we didn't have them in Vietnam. That was another thing. I got that fixed when I got back. But, and the standard CEP that the Air Force claimed was about 200 meters, but actually it was closer to 1,000 meters. Because the way you deliver these things, your aircraft is coming in like this, and depending upon the skill and the perseverance of the pilot and the defenses, you know, he may pull out pretty high up, and accuracy, you know, 20 or 30 mil, so you don't get anything inside, really. But if you just make this calculation, say that the CEP is 200 meters, that means that in a radius of 200 meters, half of it bombs go in, half don't. And the radius of this thing is 5 meters, so that the probability is 5 over 200 squared times 1/2, because it's a CEP. And see, that's a pretty small number. That's 40 squared, that's 1600 times 2 is 3200. So you get
one bomb and 3200.
Right. There's a worse factor. These revetments were constructed so that they had three times as many as they needed, and you take the photography, and one day it takes overnight to get the results of the photography, and overnight they shift them all around. So we now have to put in a 1/3.
Okay.
So now you've got 1 in 10,000. Now what happened when the Air Force, I talked to Spike about this. I said, Spike, you can't do what you promised to do. He said, well, what can I do? I got to try. So they expended 100 million pounds of ordnance in this. Now, standard 500-pound bomb costs about a dollar. That then about a dollar a pound. They talk about a $100 million operation. And if you make this in 500-pound bombs, then you see it's that's 1,000 to the 5th, so 2/10 to the 5th, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that says that the probability of 10 to the -4 getting inside there. And they figured at the end, they the PDA showed that they had definitely killed 4 of these 100 guns, when a possible 10 additional damaged. You know, just about what you'd expect from the ops analysis. So that left the problem of going after the artillery in some other way,
one of which was to locate it acoustically.
Now, there was an acoustic locator, which happened to have been developed by the acoustic group in at UCLA during World War II, a very, very good bunch of acousticians, Leo Dupa, Bill Sasso, and Bob Leonard, and actually the whole team, all of whom are dead now. Anyway, this is a thing called the GR-1, and consisted of a line of Helmholtz resonator pots. See, you're looking for low frequency things. And these Helmholtz resonators are like an Erlenmeyer flask, and they have a hot wire inside. And when this pressure wave comes along, it causes a sinusoidal motion of this new air. And so the interaction with that hot filament changes the current flow, and you measure the current flow, so you can tell time of arrival. Now, this GR-1 array stretches out over about 10 kilometers. And I explained all this to Harold Hagel and said, I don't see any natural length in this problem. You know, there's the wavelength of the wave. That's pretty big, but that's not relevant. What matters is the speed of sound times the rise time that you can measure. And that's, you know, a fraction of a meter. So why don't you guys at Los Alamos build me an array, a microphone array, and the necessary computerized electronics on a 1 meter baseline, not 10 kilometers, if it's okay. They went and did it. Not 1 meter, came out 5 feet. But that was the source of what became the Wassel acoustic locator system. Beautiful system. And a radio link, didn't have any hot wires. You see, mm-hmm. One of the problems with these, the old style, is they have these wires lying on the ground, and they're always torn up with artillery, so you gotta fix them. And they have batteries, because they gotta run these hot filaments. None of that. All of this was remote, and the little microphone array would. There were 4 microphones on a cruciform thing about 5 feet in diameter. And each one of these gets a signal at a different time, and they measure the rise time, and it ships by radio the azimuth. direction. And then you have several of these scattered around, radio link, and you get coincidence about it, you know, the location of the phone. That was one of our great successes. But it's a sad, sad story. I don't know whether you want all the details.
Oh, yes.
I tried to get this thing done. Try to get it in Army Channel. See, nothing gets done. All of this is outside channel. To get anything done, one of a kind. But to get anything in production and get the Army to adopt it, that's like pulling teeth. So I tried to find a guy who would take this on in the Army staff and pursue it. And I finally found a young colonel, Lieutenant Colonel, who was really enthusiastic about it. He said, I'm going to go to Vietnam. He said, I'm due to go to Vietnam, and I'm going to pull from that end. So I thought, well, we got it really wired now. He went out there, and the third day he was there, he got killed in a helicopter crash.
Mm.
So back to square one. So I went to, they had other problems. I was supposed to have a kind of a blank check as far as funding these things was concerned. I didn't have any money, but it was supposed to come out of ARPA. And this initial development at Los Alamos cost about $50K, and we had, I think, maybe three or four sets of this developed. And then Harold wanted his money, and I went to Johnny and I said, hey, you know, we promised Harold to support this, $50K. Hey, they're Christ-sake, you know, they've got $200 million, let them take it out of their hide. Well, you can see how that went. And, you know, I was just very annoyed, and I never got anything else out of Los Alamos.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we finally got the Army to produce, well, I had made a demonstration, this is now later in my career out there, I had made a demonstration of quite a number of these things that we had sponsored development of to General Abrams, and I demonstrated this thing, and he said, my God, we could use 1,000 of those. The reason was, you never heard about this, but practically every night there were something like 30 attacks by fire. This would be on either military installation or on villages or whatever. And what happened is the communists would come in with mortars and rockets, set up, get everything ready, fire them off and take off, you know, before you could do anything about it. Now, in those, there was an average of 6 shells launched, maybe by mortar or whatever, and an average of 6.2 people killed. So you can make an equivalence, okay? 1 shell, 1 life. When our forces invaded Cambodia, and Nixon came on to justify that, you know, he pointed to these enormous piles of mortar shells and whatnot. But there was no connection. The next time I was in Washington, I went to see Al Haig, who was Kissinger's assistant there, and I said, why the hell don't you guys put this in human terms so people can understand it? You know, you got 80,000 mortar shells captured. That's 80,000 lives, for Christ's sake. But, you know, no connection. Anyway, so General Abe was really impressed with this. We could use 1,000 of them. So I transmitted that to the other end of my chain in the Pentagon, who was Leonard Sullivan. And so it got translated into 25. The Army was going to make 25 of these. And when they got around to it, they made 5 of them. But by that time, I'd rotated out of Vietnam, so I tried to keep in touch with what was going on. And they twixed out to USARB, which was the Army element there, and where do you want these things? And they got an answer back, What are they? We don't even want them. You know, it's just absolutely frustrating. Now, if I'd been there, you know, I would have been on top of it. Another thing. Now, I used to think that the last stronghold of slave labor were the graduate students. Not quite true. It's really the artillery. Every time you move an artillery battery, you got to dig in and fill 50,000 sandbags, which takes quite a while. So, you know, it always annoyed me. Here, we've got these slaveys out there doing that. This is supposed to be a nation that knows how to mechanize things. Why don't we get a ditcher sandbagger that will cut a trench that you can take refuge in, and at the same time deliver the spoil high enough so you can put a bag under it to fill a sandbag. I had a young fellow there from one of the labs, the name of Jim Keep. And I said, Jim, go back and buy two ditchers and send them out. Well, you can't just do that. You know, it's got to go through channels. There was a thing called the Limited War Lab. It was pretty limited. Anyway, this went to them. And by God, eventually, about a year later, there arrived at the 7th Aerial Port two ditcher sandbaggers. And one of my guys was there, and he came flying in. Bring your cameras. Anyway, we got these things. The contribution of the Limited War Lab was to put that step on to hold the bag and to put a big plaque on it that says Limited War Lab. Big brass plaque. Anyway, these came out under Army auspices. And I had a very energetic guy who was an Army colonel, but who was my field guy with the Marines. He was very close to Tommy Tompkins, who was the commanding general over that whole northern court area. And this was just at the time when Quezon was heating up. Remember the siege of Quezon? And the Marines didn't have a goddamn thing up there. They needed this thing to dig communication trenches and whatnot. So Ed Caesar, who was my guy up there, I don't know, I never asked how they did these things, but he had ways of doing things. He got a C-124 out of Tokyo. I don't know how the hell he did it. And he stole one of these. he set it up to Quezon. And I had a guy stationed at USARI headquarters in Long Bend. And I said, you know, let's clear our baffles with the people there. So he went to see BG, who was chief of staff. And he says, we want to take one of these up to the Marines. No way, says old Bob Tabor. Give him a big argument. It turned out that my guy had already cleared it with his commanding general, so we got it up there. And it really served a very useful purpose. The other one was kept in a pool so that when an artillery battery moved, we could ship the thing out and give it to them. But you see the kind of practical problem.
Yes, yes.
And these are only very few. I had 300 of these.
You had quite a staff group working with you.
Yes, I had at any one time about 25 people. Mm-hmm.
And were you in general? Then the military was really on your side with what you were doing.
Oh yeah. Really, oh yeah.
Got tremendous support from.
Well,
that.
See that I lived with Westmoreland gave me a lot of additional clout. I never used it, but I think everybody was afraid. By God, if they didn't cooperate, they'd get clobbered. Sometimes we got into trouble. I had one guy who was an intelligence expert, and we had there is an area up here in the north, in Ashaw Valley, and those damn North Vietnamese moved in there we had special forces camps in there, and they overran them. And the bastards even brought in a gasoline pipeline all the way from North Vietnam into there. You know, talk about...
Incredible.
At any rate, there were three airfields in there, and we had a project to worry about possible applications of dirty things they could do, which the airfield figured. So this guy, my intelligence officer, was an Air Force officer, and he had a lot of old pals in the throughout the intelligence community, and he induced some of the Air Force guys to run a bunch of missions over Paschal. They had, you know, thousands of feet of this 8-inch film, and we knew where every bloody thing was in that place. Well, the first cab turned out there was an unfortunate thing. I was on a visit back to the States when they planned this Paschal Valley offensive, so I didn't know about it. The first cab moved in there right in the teeth of all these anti-aircraft guns sitting around, and they had 28 helicopters shot down the first day. Just a slaughter. So I said, my God, to my intelligence, Billy, you better get up there with that film. So he went up to talk to Tolman, who was his commanding general, and Tolman was ready to hang him. Where was this information when I needed it? Well, lack of communication. But there's a funny thing, you know, the military, there's a fatal flaw in some of the way they operate, in that the commanding general will tell you what the objective is. You know, you go take that, but he won't give them instructions how to do it. And he leaves it up to that guy to ask for anything he needs. So the guy goes in blinded on any intelligence, nothing, you know, because he's afraid to ask for it. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you mean, boy? You know,
yeah.
You know, your predecessor didn't need all that stuff. It's a mess. That ought to be fixed. Well, maybe enough about that. But it was, let me say, just finish off one thing. Most of the time, whether it's in academic work or in the kind of stuff we do here, you know, you write a report, it may be a glowing little gem, you send it off into the blue and you never hear anything from it. It was different in Vietnam. There were all kinds of problems that were useful, that would save lives, actually save lives on both sides. Once it was decided to attack one of those problems, there were all resources necessary, like this combat trap thing. You know, we did that in 2 weeks. It took them 6 months to do the first one when it got back to the States. And you got immediate feedback. You know, it worked or it didn't work, or thanks for your help. Very different. Very, very satisfying in that sense. A lot more personal satisfaction than the things we do back in the States.